name is Andreina.
And my name is Gabriela, and this is Wicks and Candles,
a podcast about two sisters and their obsession with period film.
Join us on a trip through palaces and manors, balls and tea parties, and a lot of dresses, carriages, and of course, wicks and candles.
In this episode, Corsage. So Gabby, I'm so looking forward to this conversation. Not only because we've been longing to talk about this movie since it came out, but also because we have a very special guest today.
Yes, and it's someone I know very well, since it happens to be my own husband, Dr. Christian Merken.
Yes, that's amazing. And we are very excited to finally have him on our podcast. We've been planning and talking about it for a while, and it's finally happened. And we must add about this very distinguished guest that we have invited, not only because he's Gabby's husband, but because he is really knowledgeable about history, and in particular, German and Austrian history. Welcome, Dr. Merken.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited and honored to be finally part of this podcast series that I've, of course, observed for a long period of time now. And yeah, to have the chance to be here with such knowledgeable ladies about and talk about period film is a great opportunity for me. So you could say this is a dream come true.
Wow, that's amazing, Christian. Thank you so much. I didn't know it was a dream for you, but, you know, that's what we're here for, to make dreams come true. Thank you so much for being here. And before we continue, I just want to say congratulations on your completion of your PhD, which you just did. You just received your PhD just a week ago, I think. So congratulations. And we can happily and very proudly introduce you as Dr. Christian Merken in our podcast.
Thank you so much. Perfect
timing. Okay, so Gabby, to start, can you give us some facts about the movie before we go into the discussion?
Sure, Nene. So let me give you the most important facts about the film Corsage. It's a 2022 film written and directed by Austrian filmmaker Marie Kreutzer. It stars Vicky Krieps as Empress Elizabeth and Florian Teichtmeister as Emperor Franz Joseph, just to mention the main cast. The film was a co-production among Austria, Luxembourg, Germany, and France, and it had its world premiere in the Cannes Film Festival in May 2022 on the section Un Certain Regard, which is a section that presents films with unusual styles and non-traditional stories. And in general, the reception of the film was quite positive. Some of the most significant accolades include the awards for Vicky Krieps as Best Actress on this section on the Cannes Festival, and also on the European Film Awards. The film also got the award for Best Film on the London Film Festival. And that's just to mention a few of the many other nominations it also received on several international film festivals. One interesting piece of information is also that this will be the official submission for Austria for the Best International Feature Film category of the 95th Academy Awards in 2023. Fun fact, just to start, and we will certainly talk about this later on in our discussion. The director, Marie Kreutzer, she was not interested at the beginning on doing a film about Sisi. But she had worked with Vicky Krieps on another film, and it was Vicky, the actress, who dropped this idea to Marie Kreutzer and said, let's do our own interpretation of Sisi, and she didn't like him. So they didn't talk about it after that first conversation. But 3 years later, the actress Vicky Krieps found the script in her mailbox, and that's when she figured out, okay, I think Marie is ready to go on this endeavor. I found that quite interesting.
Wow.
So yeah, those are the main facts. Now it's your turn, Enid, to give us a short summary on the story.
Yeah, thank you so much for those facts, Gabby. Very interesting. So just I'm going to give you a very brief summary of the movie. It's a quite interesting one in that the plot is almost plotless. So here it goes. Corsage tells the story of Empress Elizabeth of Austria as she deals with the reality of reaching middle age. Sisi, as the Empress was affectionately called by her subject, is nearing 40, and her marriage to Emperor Franz Joseph I is effectively loveless. The movie follows a few intriguing episodes in Sisi's life as she re-examines her marriage, her past, and especially her role and legacy as Empress. Okay, so let's start with the first topic, which we think is very prominent throughout the movie, which was Elizabeth's obsession with beauty. As the film shows, Sisi was a renowned beauty among the people that surrounded her. And the film shows that she was obsessed with youth and with maintaining her looks. So what are your thoughts on this? Is there historical evidence to this obsession? Christian, let's start with you.
Mm-hmm. My thought, there's two major thoughts on this. Let's start with the factual part. Is there historical evidence? Yes, there is indeed quite a lot, actually. She was nearly daily going to her own private gym, which was something extraordinary at the time, that a woman would have a kind of gym. And if you go to the Hofburg in Vienna today, you can even see some of her sports goods that she used daily to maintain her figure and her looks. Another thing is that she was a known chain smoker, which was also something absolutely extraordinary at the time, when it was not very glamorous for women to smoke. So that an empress would smoke daily quite a lot of cigarettes, even when she was in the coach with Emperor Franz Joseph, her husband, she would smoke, much to his dislike. But she did that, of course, kind of to control her appetite, because she was very, very keen to maintain her figure. And another thing is that all the pictures that we know of her as of today, were taken until her 30th birthday. So after her 30th birthday, she refused to ever have a picture taken of her ever again, because she wanted the people to remember her being a young, beautiful woman. And the last thing is that her hair, which even on the pictures you can tell, it's quite a lot. In fact, it reached down to her ankles. So it took quite a while to get her hair done in the morning for the women who had to do that. So yes, there's a lot of evidence that she was a very vain person, and she was aware of that. And there's one little fun fact. The day before she was eventually killed, the real Sisi, by an Italian anarchist in Switzerland, she was thinking of having another picture, photographic picture, taken of her. And she was really tempted to do so. But then in the end, she said, no, I stick to this rule for such a long time. And even if it's, and there's a quote of her that she was, that she said at the day, she said, even if it was just for vanity, you have to stick for your rules. So yes, she was a very vain person. On the other hand, and I think that's kind of making her so interesting, because she's, as we see also in this film, she's such a free spirit. She's an empress very much unlikely empress at the time, if you think of the role of women in her age. So that she was on one hand such a free spirit that kind of ignored the rules, but on the other hand, she was taking so much time to maintain her beauty and represent her beauty as an empress. I think that's a very nice way that you can see how kind of torn she was as a woman, like who had to fulfill a certain role on the one hand and kind of was thinking in a very, very different way on the other hand.
Wow. That is interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the smoking in regards with her appetite, because we see both of this very nicely intertwined in the film, how she was constantly smoking. Of course, we see it mainly as a part of the rebellion. She wants to break this courtesy rule, women shouldn't smoke. But at the same time, in the film, it's shown very often how little she would eat. Yeah, from in my eyes, she had an eating disorder. With our modern view, we can say she had an obvious eating disorder, that she would just eat of all these delicious pancakes that they were served. She would only eat this orange slice or a nice little cup of broth and nothing else. So I think here it was very well depicted in the film how she worked on this, how much she invested on this, that it was a constant work on keeping her weight down. It's a rough part of the story. Mm-hmm.
If I may just add one more little thing, because like you mentioned, eating disorder, and a lot of people at her time thought so. And I was just reading a chapter by a historian, and he said that he doubts whether it was really an eating disorder, because she absolutely made sure that she would get enough proteins and fats and vitamins. She was very aware of a healthy diet. Mm. So she would make sure to have just enough of everything. So yes, you could probably still say, is it like an eating disorder? But it was very controlled. She controlled it, and it was very driven by her aim that she wanted to stay slim and beautiful.
Yeah. I love both of your perspectives, and I love, Christian, that you are kind of basing it on the evidence that exists. And I'm not sure, I don't think she's the most well-known queen or empress, European empress. I don't think there's a lot of information out there, so it's so important to have some of that, you know, factual base to the movie. Makes it more compelling. And what Gabby said about, you know, the link between the cigarettes and the appetite, absolutely, because I didn't make the link. I made the link more with, you know, the film shows that she had a rebellious streak, which we're going to touch on in our second point of discussion. But yeah, absolutely, that will help her control her appetite. And I think what we can, for me, because I was also looking for some information about her, and, you know, eating, I think there's a few terms, eating disorder. There's also disordered eating, which is slightly different. She could be called like a health nut, which is very conscious, you know, and is kind of borderline eating disorder. People who are so obsessed with what they're eating that it becomes like a ruling part of their day-to-day life, like it consumes their lives. But what I found interesting in one of the kind of historical videos that I was watching was that she had very little control of her life in many ways, right? As a woman of the period, but also as an empress, and apparently her mother-in-law was very, very controlling throughout her life until she died, and she controlled the way she raised her children and many other things. And perhaps that obsession with the food and obsession with her body was one of the very few ways that she could have some control in her life. And I think mm-hmm. I think that rang very true. When you have nothing else, what else can you control but your own body. Like, really, nobody can force you to put food in your mouth, like, literally. So perhaps, you know, because it's very interesting why, where, what would be the origin of this? It's definitely beyond vanity for me, because you said she was a vain person, but for me, yeah, there's vanity, but what is the underlying desire? And maybe this is the one, you know, this is the one thing I can control, which is my appearance, my body. So, you know, maybe I'm psychoanalyzing too much, but it is perhaps, you know, one of the ways we can see it. And I think the movie shows that very, very well. She ate very little. And it's all intertwined. It's all intertwined, you know, her resistance to the role she was put in, but also her obsession with her body and her physicality and her body. It's quite complex.
Yeah, I absolutely, if I may add that, I agree with you, Nina. I think that it's very likely that this was something that she could control and that nobody else had an influence upon her, because the rest of her life, and I think also the title of the film, Corsage, I mean, what represented more the suppression of women and the role that they were literally squeezed into than the corsage of the time that they had to wear, and that this was something that she could control, and
yeah,
to an extreme extent. Yeah. For example, her waist size through all of her life stayed at 42 centimeters. Now, if you measure 42 centimeters and you put it in a circle, then you see that that was kind of like the waist size in comparison of a bee, if you want.
Wow.
But I think, yeah, I think you're right. I think that this was something, the body she could control, and therefore this was kind of her little, yeah, empire that she was the reign of.
Yeah, that's so good, Christian. I also think the movie, because the movie, like I said, when I was talking about this, giving the summary of the movie, it's very loose. There's not any, this is not a historical film. There's not any major historical events that happen. This is a very kind of free-flowing narrative of things that happened to her over the course of a year. And what we learned throughout this narrative is that she feels very insecure. So we talk about the beauty, but she feels very insecure about her age as well. And there's a, you know, the hint or the suggestion that her husband, the emperor, has completely lost interest in her because she has turned 40, which is ludicrous, right, for us today. Today. So there's this topic of youth as well, and there's a plot point where we learn that the empress might be having an affair with a 18-year-old woman. So there's all these points about youth as well. So what do you two think about this? I mean, you know, at the time, there's even a scene where a doctor who's examining her, because she's being examined all the time because of her behavior, and he says, you have to take care of yourself. You realize that the life expectancy of your subjects is 40 years old. What do you think about this, Gabby?
Well, I think this is the dilemma that we mentioned just before in the discussion, yeah, that she was very well aware of her role. And this is what she was also keen, not only because she was in charge of her body, and the only thing that she could control, if we follow that theory, she was very well aware of her image and her role. She knew that she was the empress, and she knew that she had to keep a certain image. And she was, at the same time, yeah, with this contradiction that she actually didn't want to fulfill that role the way they expected it. So of course she's in that dilemma. She says, okay, I want to kind of break through from this cage of being young and beautiful. But at the same time, she felt horrified with the thoughts of reaching 40. She was completely horrified. She, for some reason, saw this like a turning point in her life, as at least as shown in the film, because this is thematized frequently enough. So I think she was just very polarized herself. She had an inner struggle, in my eyes. She was like kind of, okay, I'm going to follow my path and I want to do what I want and I want to do all my gymnastics and sports and whatever, and take care of my way the way I want it and so on. But at the same time, she was confronted constantly with this, okay, you're not the youngest anymore and you're the empress, so you have to keep an appearance. And she was torn between those two worlds.
Yeah. What do you,
at least from what I was shown on the phone.
Yeah. For me, the age part is the more puzzling. Is the more puzzling to me, because we often have, in modern times, we often have very cliche ideas of the past. And, you know, when we start learning about history and actual life expectancies and so on, we learn that, you know, perhaps she wasn't considered very old at 40. I'm not sure, actually. I'm not sure. Maybe Christian can correct me. So maybe this obsession that she had was just irrational, just was another irrational thing that she held on for control, in a way. I'm not sure if it's based on real fear that at that age you were considered to be completely disposable. I have no idea. Like, I don't have any idea historically on the perception of that age at that time. What do you think, Christian?
Well, I think, first of all, going back to the beginning, because I mentioned that she was very vain, and at the same time, she wasn't a public figure whatsoever in her time. So she was constantly traveling, as the film shows. So she's always, most of the time, she's away from Vienna. She hated it to be in Vienna. She hated it to be in the palace in Vienna. So she was constantly on the go, like doing cruises or like also climbing mountains and stuff like that. So things that women at the time all by themselves would normally never do. So she wasn't actually seen by a lot of people, apart from the people who were just around her. So I think, yes, I think her looks had more to do with control than of her thinking to be disposable or to be rejected by her husband. Because at that time, I think her affection for him had cooled down a lot. While the other way around, even though they no longer had a physical relationship or sexual relationship at the time, His letters to her are still still exist, and he has a lot of affection for her. And when she died, he was devastated, and he said that he loved that woman more than he could probably put in words. So he had even though the film doesn't show that, but the real Franz Josef he loved her dearly. Which didn't mean that he didn't have affairs. He had quite a few affairs with young women, from a middle class. And there were like arranged meetings. The husbands of these women were aware of that. They were paid off by the courts to accept the affairs that their wives would have with the emperor. And there's at least we know about five of these affairs. And of course, Sissy would also know about that. And she, it's not difficult to judge, but historians say that under the given circumstances, she was okay with that. Certainly not happy. I mean, who would be? But, you know, at that time, this was kind of considered to be normal. And she was okay with that for as long as he would allow her to pretty much live her independent lifestyle. So she was, but the main point is that she was constantly traveling, or most of the time traveling, and being by herself and being just surrounded by her servants and court ladies and ladies in waiting and whatever whoever accompany her on her trips. Well, so she wasn't representing to a larger public. audience. Yeah.
That is so interesting. That is so interesting. So all her obsessions, as far as we know, were internal, were very much self-imposed.
Yeah.
Self-imposed, yeah. Rules for herself, self-imposed, for the staff around, like for the staff around her. And there's a couple scenes where she wears like a full, veil on her face, and she has one of her ladies in waiting to play her role, and the movie shows that she could get away with that kind of trickery because people didn't get to see her that often, and it was all about body language, you know, the silhouette of her clothes, that they will be judging, but not her face, which is I found absolutely fascinating, and especially at a time period where obviously there were no photographs around and so on, so she could get away with it. But yeah, that's so fascinating that it was very much a self-imposed regime that she had.
If I may just add, because I think this was one of the most fascinating parts of the film for me, that her court lady, I guess the real one was called Irma Satarai, so that she kind of slipped into her role. And I thought this was a very nice symbolism of the film, because the picture that we have, or the image that we have of Sissi today, at least if you go to Vienna and you see the paintings of her, and you see, of course, that this entire tourism industry that is created for Sissi, if you see that image that has barely nothing to do with a real woman. And I thought this was so interesting in the film to see that actually the real Sissi is kind of disappearing. And you see that this one scene where even her daughter said, Mommy, when you gave that speech, I guess she says something like, you were so glamorous or so elegant. And it wasn't her.
Yep.
You know, so it was her court lady who gave that speech. And I thought that was very well done in the film to show how the real woman disappears behind an image that is created of her by another woman that isn't her. So, I thought that was very fascinating, because that kind of symbolizes what really happened, that the entire image we have was created after her death and had barely anything to do with who she really was.
Well, the director of the film, Marie Kreutzer, has mentioned in many of the interviews that she gave on this film that, of course, she used some historical frame to tell the story, but that she was very well aware that she wanted to keep her artistic liberty to tell the story. So I think this is very nice what you both just mentioned. This is a very nice coup of Marie Kreutzer. What she made you believe and what she then added on to make the film special and her own interpretation of the story. I think we have to say, okay, this is certainly something unique of the film and something that really worked out very well.
Yeah, Gabby, that's so interesting. And Christian, thank you for that observation, because it truly is important, I think, to understand this movie. And I also saw a few interviews with the director, and she said, you know, I did read the biographies and I did read the major books on her, but there's so little really known about her that ultimately those biographies and those historical accounts of her lives are also interpretations. So this is my interpretation. And I found that really interesting. She really had a firm grasp of the vision of how she viewed this person. And I think that makes the film much, much richer. Okay, so we have touched on this a little bit while we talk about the, you know, her obsession with beauty. Sissi, as we learn through this interpretation of her life in this movie, in Corsage, was actually a quite rebellious person. She had a rebellious streak, which start or manifest in some ways in her refusal to eat. Like, for example, she would refuse to eat during not only her personal private time, but during formal dinners with other diplomats and at the court, which could be seen as a major, major faux pas. And, you know, the smoking, and there's, these are minor, like there's many other manifestations of a rebellious streak, a rebellious nature throughout the movie. So can we talk about this and how we call this topic is the failed rebellion of a woman? Because yes, she did rebel, but the feeling that we have is that she unfortunately failed to accomplish what you wanted to accomplish through this rebellion. So, Gabby, maybe you can start with this one. What are your thoughts on this?
I think this is really up to discussion. Was it really a rebellion? You know, for in our eyes, with our 2022 looking glass, mm-hmm. back to those times, you know, it might seem for us rebellious, you know, that she had, that she would smoke, or that she would do many more sports than any average woman of that time, you know? So can we really call it a rebellion? I don't know. I think it's maybe even more this interpretation of her character through this film, that they wanted to show her more rebellious than what she maybe actually was. As we just mentioned, there is very little information about her own personality and so on. It's very, yeah, little records of what she really was and what she really liked and so on. So are we maybe putting so much, are we projecting so much hope, you know, on her figure? Like, this was a woman that was like kind of out of her time and out of her context, because she would do too much sports, or she would, you know, go riding whenever she wanted. Maybe are we putting too much on her shoulders on this character, or was this really rebellious for those times as well?
That's a very important observation, because if we have one pet peeve in Wicks and Candles, is the exceptional woman, as we have talked in other episodes, the exceptional woman, you know, she was not like other women of her time. She was smarter. She knew mm-hmm. better. She was rebellious.
She was more modern.
Yeah. And this is a pet peeve that we have, that our main characters are, you know, taken out of their time, and they kind of refuse to follow the rules. They're smarter. They're feminist before their time. And you know what, Gabby? Although I appreciate this point, because it's a dangerous path that a lot of movies take, I don't think this is the case in this one. And the reason I say that is because the way I have framed this question is, in the movie, although we know she had, I think, three children, one of them who died in infancy. She had four children, I think. The only child, well, we see two children, the eldest son who goes to the military. So he's old enough. He's 18, I think. And then her youngest daughter, Valerie. And the movie shows the relationship. And I think this is one of the most fascinating relationships in the movie, because throughout the movie, it is Valerie that serves as the mirror of a society that is judging Sissy. I found that so interesting. There's one scene, the Empress was really a warm, caring person in real life, as I understand. And she in the movie, she visits a couple of hospitals, both for women with mental health issues and more for men, and I think war veterans. And there's a very important scene where she goes to the hospital, and there's this man who has lost a leg, and she asks him, what do you want? And he says, I will die for a cigarette. And she actually takes a cigarette, one for him, one for her. She lights it up, and she lights, and she said, make room for me. And she lights in bed with them as they smoke this cigarette. And when they come out of the hospital, this is a wonderful scene. I really loved it. And we can talk about that later when we talk about the performance of the actress, because she makes it work. She sits in the carriage and she's with Valerie, who's about 10. And she says, Valerie, I'm so sorry. You should not have seen this. There were, you know, wounded men and men that are dying. And she says, I'm so sorry. You should not have seen this. And Valerie, what she answers is, Mama, why did you smoke? It is so unglamorous. And you should not be doing this in public. So Valerie is actually judging her mom for her actions. And this is not the only time. She does it throughout the movie. It's always very unexpected that this little girl, who is the next generation of women, is used as the mirror of the society that she's trying to. It is funny that this is where it comes from. And I don't know, I still don't have the answer, but what do you think about this, Christian, Gabi?
Well, again, looking at the historical facts, probably to give a little bit of a frame. Her first daughter, as you mentioned, died when she was, I guess, 2 years old on a trip to Hungary. Yeah. She was very sick. And then she had two other daughters, Marie, Valerie, and Gisela. Gisela isn't shown in the film. But if you look at the lives of Marie, Valerie, and Gisela, you see that both of them absolutely lived up to the expectations of their time. Mm. So they both got married to, again, also like cousins, second great cousins of the same family. One got back Gisela married, back to Bavaria, so back into the family of her mother. While Marie Valerie, if I'm not mistaken, married a second cousin to her from the Austrian side. So, and they both lived the life that you would expect of women of her class at the time. So they were very traditional. And I guess that is the interesting part, you know, that Sissy is like this rebellious woman who is probably way ahead of her time. But then, and I think this is very clever done in the film, that they show, like, already see that the daughter that they just show in the film, that she represents exactly the traditional, conservative views of the time and showing that back. So it's partly the, as you say, the mirror of the society. Yes, you can use it like that, but it's even factually true that her daughters live a very, very conservative lives. So even though they were raised by her, and it's interesting that they portray Marie Valerie in this film because Sissy dearly loved her. And she took her on many of her trips when she was traveling. So Marie Valerie really experienced the free spirit of her mom to a large extent. And even though she stayed to be like, within lived her life within the boundaries of her time and the society she was born into.
Wow.
So I think then, our thesis, what we started with at the beginning, Nanny, our thesis, we could, among these three panel speakers, we can confirm that it was a failed rebellion, that she really tried to break the mold. And she didn't even go beyond her daughter because her daughter said, okay, it's nice that you do it, mommy, but it doesn't look right to me. I'm still going to stick to the rules. If we think, okay, how they portrayed it in the film, which is cleverly done, and what really happened in real life. And there was also one scene in the film where Sissy stands up from the table and she walks out of the room showing the middle finger, you know. And I think this is, again, another touch of the of the movie production to kind of add to this myth of how rebellious she was. But actually, of course, something like that wouldn't have happened.
No.
Back then.
Yeah, that's so good, Gabby. Yeah, it's a failed rebellion because it didn't carry through, right? It didn't carry it died with her. It didn't carry through with her daughters. But you know, something I found very interesting is that this is a very there are several men depicted in the film, and we're gonna touch on those hopefully in a minute. She had her entourage, right? Her ladies in waiting, the maids that she deals with. And I think through them, something carried. I think she was very safe with them. And in many ways, this is a very feminine film where most, not all of them, but a lot of the scenes happen within women. There's a time when she goes, like Christian mentioned, she traveled extensively. And there are periods when she's just surrounded by her, you know, ladies in waiting, and they are funny with her, understanding, very caring throughout all her decisions. She was, and I think this is part of the narrative of her rebelliousness, is that she was not sexually repressed. She was unloved, which is funny, Christian, because she said that her husband loved her. But here, in this 1 year of her life, what we see is her reaching out to her husband, who rejects her constantly. Like, she's so hungry for love and affection and physical touch all the time. Like, she's so in need of physical love. And part of the quote-unquote rebelliousness and free spirit is that she tries to get on with a few men throughout the movie, and it never happens. She really loves her writing instructor, and you know, she was a great writer, and she would write many hours of the day. And there's a few scenes where she, you know, is suggested that they are lovers, but actually nothing happens. Nothing happens between them. Though rumors,
if I may jump in, you know, the impression I had was that she wanted to be loved, but also based on how I interpreted this. This is maybe a little bit too.
Let me grab my glass of wine. Interpretation.
Well, let's see. I thought her intent of reaching out to men, like to this writing instruction, and to her cousin Ludwig, and to her husband, which I think was, I don't know if she was really wanting to be, again, loved by him. I think it was just her longing for confirmation of what we have just spoken. Am I still young and beautiful? So for me, it was not really the look for love and the need for real love, but the search for confirmation. Am I still appeal? Do I still have this appeal to men? Am I still attractive? I was looking for the confirmation.
Wow.
Is it still all worth it, what I'm doing to keep my weight, to keep my fitness and whatever?
Wow.
That's how I saw it.
Ooh, that's a very interesting take, because I didn't see it at all that way.
Because all the scenes where she interacts with men and she gets really close with men, you know, like with the writing instruction, you think they're going to kiss or make love or whatever in this scene where they're meeting in this chimney room, and she's very sparely dressed with her writing clothing, and her arms are naked. You know, she hasn't got a dress. She has pants and a corset. And you think something's going to happen, but it's all very cold. It's all very cold. You don't really feel passion. You feel her aim is to get the confirmation, am I still attractive? And this happens again with her cousin when they're jumping in bed, and this happens again with her husband when they're in bed. She just wants to feel like, am I still attractive at 40, and has this all this pain paid off? That's how I see it. I don't know. If you want to add something to that.
That is fascinating. I didn't think of it that way, but I think it's I think is very valid. What do you think, Christian, briefly? What do you think about this? Was she actually longing for human connection, or was she just looking for that confirmation of, you know, am I still lovable? Well,
I think that what Gabi just mentioned with her cousin, King Ludwig of the second of Bavaria, they had a very strong bond, the two of them, because he, just as her, was a very free spirit and very well ahead of his time. And so I think that really it was, in that case, they could relate to each other, because both of them were not accepted by society. And Ludwig was also someone who was very much withdrawn from society. He barely took part in any public events and stuff like that. He didn't care for that at all. So I think that this is just showing her that there's someone that she can absolutely relate to. Now, to coming to her writing instructor, the part that is portrayed there in England, it is kind of questionable whether they really had an affair ever. Most historians say no, that they just liked each other, that they kind of were good friends, but that never had any romantic aspect to it. And I think that she was just looking for people who would accept her the way she was, and whenever she found someone who kind of didn't reject her because she was such a free spirit, there was something that she was looking for. And probably she could find that with a writing instructor who accepted her the way. And she clearly, and that is also, again, factually proven, she found it with her cousin, the king of Bavaria, Ludwig II. So I guess it was more, not so much for, that's my interpretation, that she wanted to be seen as attractive, but I guess she just needed people to connect with who would understand her way of thinking, because she was literally stuck in this corsage of the court in Vienna, which was so strict and conservative and formal, and she just, of course, needed also people who would understand her lifestyle and go along with it and accept her for who she was.
Yeah, thank you for that, Christian.
There's maybe just one tiny little anecdote that I would like to add to that, because it fits here, that I just read recently. Because she was the younger daughter, but maybe this is also briefly important. Factually, it was her older sister Sophie who was supposed to marry Franz Josef. But Franz Josef fell in love with Sissi. So... and for being the second daughter, of course, when she grew up as a kid, she had way more freedom than her older sister. Her older sister was prepared to be an empress or a queen one day. Sissi wasn't. And in fact, it is known that her father said that he expected Sissi to join a circus sooner or later.
Wow. So,
of course, absolutely unacceptable for a daughter of like a royal daughter, but kind of giving, he was describing by that how free spirited she was. She didn't care for any of these rules at court. She was caring for sports and riding and being out and so on. Yeah. So yeah, and I think that kind of. If you're then stuck in this role to be the empress and to have to represent her, we see this at the beginning of the film. It starts with her that she has to attend this event, and then she pretends that she faints just to get out of this situation.
Yeah.
And I guess there again, she just needed people around her. She needed a surrounding that would accept her.
Wow, all good theories.
A good series. And I think this is a good transition to our next topic, because you mentioned that before, Nene, how the performance of Vicky Krieps is so believable and makes pretty much the core of the entire film, because she is not too modern in her performance. She is, you see in her performance, she is totally in character and she doesn't take you out all the time. So she makes you completely submerge in that surrounding. So I think this is part of the entire visual style of the entire film. And this would be our next topic of discussion. How much of this is really supporting the story, and how much is it really just a nice add-on? Does really the entire visual style of the film adds to the storytelling, or is it just for the looks of the story? What are your thoughts about this? Maybe we start with you, Nene, because you brought this in character and all this of the looks and the performance of the actress to the conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Gabby. Thank you for this, for bringing this topic up. I think it's very important because this is a quite memorable movie, to be honest with you, visually. It seems very simple, but it isn't. I've seen this movie twice. I was very lucky to see it both times in the movie theater, so that gives you another, you know, beautiful perspective, because you're seeing it on a very large screen. And I was really struck by the visual beauty of the movie and the sense of place. There's a very strong sense of place. So for me, this is as important as the character of Sissi. I will say that the environment, it's like another character, like Bavaria, where you live. If I can reveal that, it's very much a character in this movie. And if I can add, this movie was shot on film, not a digital camera. And mm-hmm. I think you can absolutely tell, because the cinematography of this movie is extraordinary. But I think you're referring to something a little bit more, because I'm talking about nature. I'm talking about the type of landscapes where Sissi lived. You know, she lived among them, you know, she lived between the Bavarian mountains. This is she spent a lot of time away from Vienna. So she was not a city. This is not a city royalty movie where you see all these balls, candles, carriages. No, this is very much a countryside royalty movie where you see landscapes and animals and horses and country houses and these type of palaces that are less luxurious and elegant. It's very much an outdoors movie too.
But, you know, the thing that I was hoping that you maybe touch, you mentioned that her performance and how she portrays Sissi was so in the time, so that she was not ahead of her time and so on. And at the same time, the movie includes a lot of modern elements. It's not a typical historic film, a typical period film. It is not. It's very unusual in the visualization. Many things are modern, starting with the soundtrack, which we just talk separately. But also because they purposely include modern elements into the entire thing. For example, you see a tractor. On one of these landscapes images, you see a carriage, but you also see a modern tractor, modern agriculture vehicle, being portrayed in the film. Or you see the furniture of the castle of Ludwig, of her cousin. It's all modern furniture. It's all modern chairs with metal bars, and you see it's modern. So this incongruity that she is very in her time, she is very in character, like she is very true to the period, but the entire surrounding is cacophonic. It's not really true to the period. We also see there's many scenes of where they show the corridor to her rooms, and there's always one guard standing by the door who opens the door and lets someone in. This we see many times. And in one of those times, we see a bucket with a mop, a modern cleaning bucket and a mop, which of course didn't exist back then. So these contradictory modern elements in the film, this doesn't add to this true feeling that you got through Vicky Krieps' performance. You said she was completely in her, she was completely in her time. She was completely Empress Sissi of the 19th century. But at the same time, the surroundings and the cinematography, like the set production, the set design, was not meant to look like that. It was meant to give you hints. Okay, this is the maybe the end of the monarchy, and we are reaching a modern era.
Well,
so how do you like that? How do you like these modern aspects in this kind of old story, where some parts are really really true to the period, but some items and some elements are completely out of the frame? What are your thoughts on that? I don't know if you want to start, Nene, or Christian wants to add something to that.
Yeah, I think when I first saw that, and the thing that kind of disturbed me when I watched the film was the scene that Gabi just mentioned, where they're on the road, and it's a very modern road, and then they stop there's a crossroad, and then there's a modern green, I don't know, John Deere or whatever tractor standing in front of the coach. And my first initial thought or a glimpse of a second was like, didn't they spot that when they filmed
it? Is this a mistake?
Is this a mistake? Of course, then you realize most certainly not. It's there on purpose, for a purpose. So, also the cleaning materials, the mop, and the, I guess it's even like a plastic bucket that stands there in the aisle. So that you have these, and the interior of Ludwig. And I guess what the interior of Ludwig is, I guess, the first, if I'm not mistaken, is the first modern things you see. Now, when I saw that in the film, I thought, because Ludwig was a very modern person. He had electricity in his castles. He had modern water toilets. He had a telephone. I guess it was his third telephone in Bavaria at all that he had. So he was a very modern character. And I first thought it was referring to his character. And then later on, you realize, no, she is actually referring to a time that is about to come. So there's more modern elements in the film. So yeah, first I thought it was a bit disturbing, but which is probably good because it makes you like, what is this about now? The same with the I don't know, we haven't mentioned it yet, but that some of the castles and the rooms and the interiors look rather shabby and look old and look used and worn
yes.
out. So also suggesting this period is coming to an end. This is going down, actually, everything, and there's another time coming. And the more I thought about it, the better I thought it was, especially because the characters stay within the time they're supposed to live in, apart from Sissi, this one little scene where she gives the middle finger, and I'm not an expert on this, but I assume that this gesture didn't exist in her time, or didn't have a meaning, especially not in Austria, so maybe in Anglo-American surroundings, but not in Austria. Anyway, so I think it was great to have this little moments where you as a viewer think like, what, why is there now a plastic bucket? There certainly wasn't a plastic bucket in the times. Why is there a tractor? And why do the castles look so shabby? I mean, the aisle between her bedroom and the room of Franz Josef is dark gray. So most certainly it was a glamorous, and in real life it should have been like a glamorous aisle with gold and marble and whatever. And it looks like a dark gray tunnel between the two rooms, which I think is just a great visual language that she's using there.
This is a nice expression what you're using, the visual language. And this has been also mentioned by her, by Marie Kreutzer, the director, that she specifically wanted rotten castles as setting, exactly to portray this, to portray the end of of monarchy and as a hint of the times that would come. I found it difficult to get, you know, as a viewer, and I'm watching a period film, even though it's an unusual period film that is not 100% true to history, I found it hard to get the right meaning, to understand what she wanted to convey, you know? That it got my attention, yes. It got my attention that the furniture in Ludwig's castle was modern, and I also analyzed it like that. Is it okay? Because he was very avant-garde for his time, so they wanted to make it his place. They wanted to make modern, like ahead of his time. Okay, I understand. But if you don't go backstage on this film, I think the meaning of those modern elements is not clear. It's not clear for the majority of the audience, what she really wanted to convey. So in a way, it was a clever visual language, as you mentioned, Kristen. It's like a clever visual language, what she wanted to portray with that. But if you're not familiar with history, and if you don't think a little bit beyond, okay, what time is this? Is this the end of the 19th century? So First World War is just around the corner. If you don't go beyond the film, you might not get what she's trying to tell you. You might not get this analogy of this is a rotten castle because it's the end of the monarchy, because it's the 20th century knocking on the door, and this is going to happen. So I think it is well done, and it was a clever strategy of the director and the production team. I just think it is not clear for the masses. Maybe I'm underestimating the audience. I don't know. But for me, and even, I don't know, we watch a lot of period films.
Yeah.
And even for me, it was hard to get, you know, okay, what did they really, artistically, what did they really mean to convey with this? I had to read a lot. I had to.
Ooh, that is...
Go beyond the film. So I don't know. Do you think she reached her goal, Nene?
I don't know.
Did she touch the point?
No, but that's such an important point.
And how do you feel if you think intuitively? If you just think without just knowing what we have just shared. If you see just a film and you sit there and you say, okay, this is very modern. And at the last scene, we see the final scene is the Empress with her ladies in court on a very modern ship. So this is like the last, okay, I am not hiding this as a storyteller. I am not hiding this modernity. I am showing you this is a very old empress. What Kristen mentioned, that the character stayed in, you know, the figure stayed like true to the time, but the world around
kept moving,
going beyond and moving forward very fast, you know? So the last final scene of the empress on the ship, on a very modern ship, was like the last card that the director is showing you. Okay, so this is the contrast. So now you deal with it. You know, did you like that? Was that appealing to you, or did you think like, okay,
I don't know. You know what? These are all such amazing points that I keep shaking my head. I keep interjecting. It didn't take me out of the movie at all. And maybe it's because I saw it in the movie theater. Perhaps the quality was such. The beauty of the cinematography was so high that, and I think she got away. For me, it didn't take me out. In fact, I have to admit, okay, maybe I was taking notes. Maybe I was taking too many notes. I didn't notice the tractor. I did not notice the tractor, but perhaps that's what she intended, that you will accept this world as it was. For it, to me, every single thing felt appropriate, and maybe, and I'm just gonna say maybe, she got away with it because she shot this movie on film. Because I was just mesmerized by the beauty of this, the quality of the image, and the equalizing nature. Like, if this is a poorly made movie, like if you shot this in digital, perhaps all those aspects, and I mean, we're getting on the technical aspects here, perhaps all those modern aspects will clash even more, but there's such a unifying, the light in this movie is glorious. The whole movie, the light is incredible. The light of this castles. And you know what? I did go, and I admired this before I saw the interviews. Like, this was one of the highlights for me before I heard her talk about it. When they initially started to prepare the movie, she brought all the people, you know, the set designers, all these people who have worked on many, many period films, and they brought all the candles. There were going to be a lot of candles in this movie because it was period appropriate. She said, no, wait a minute. I don't want to romanticize anything around her. There was electricity already at the time. Let's use electrical mm-hmm. lamps. And what she said is that, you know, slowly they start to strip, you know, I think what she wanted to deconstruct was the idea of that we as viewers have of period film. When we go to a period film, a lot of us were, oh my God, let's look at the furniture, let's look at the curtains, and look at the vases and the paintings on the walls. And, you know, we want to be submerged in that. And I think she wanted to focus so much on the character, on the interior life of this person, that she, with a lot of intention, she said, I was stripping out. I think she stripped out as much as she could without, you know, living like a bare stage. I think for me, it worked.
It worked. So for you, it worked. Well, but, I mean, that you didn't notice a tractor is okay, but I mean, the ship.
Yeah, the modern ship. Yeah, I think she...
You cannot oversee
no,
that.
But her, Sissy, fit for me in each of these places so perfectly that I didn't, like, the anachronism didn't check, because I felt that she fit in all these places so perfectly. Maybe if I see it at home again, okay, I will notice. I did notice one scene it was so striking for me, with, you know, the shabbiness of these castles. When there's a scene where the emperor goes to her room and he's waiting. I don't remember what she was doing and why she took a while to open, but he's waiting by the door, and there's like a bunch of golden chairs just stacked on top of each other.
Stacked up.
Like after a party. Like there was a party, yes, and then the chairs were all stacked up there on the hallway as people clean. I found that amazing. Like, I found that like an amazing detail that I loved.
Amazing detail. Well, so for you it worked, because this is exactly what Marie Kreutzer wanted to achieve. You know, she wanted to convey this feeling of, okay, the monarchy is coming to an end. And I quote, she said in an interview, she wanted to give you the feeling that the expensive furniture has already been sold. This is what she wanted to.
Wow. And all you have is those stacked up chairs, like left over from the party. Yeah, they're in the hallway.
The party's over.
The party's over. Oh, that, see, that for me, it worked. The party's over, yeah.
Very well. So, Nene,
should we?
Are we ready for our quiz?
Yeah, because we have taken quite a long time to discuss these three topics. And I want to thank you both for your insights and all your opinions. But here, while we do our quiz, we'll have a chance to just explore a couple more things. So the moment has arrived to do our Wicks and Candles quiz, which we introduce as a new section this season. So we have four questions as part of the quiz, and we're going to go around the table answering this question. So the first question in our questionnaire is, what is your sweaty Wick? Which means one thing you didn't like about the movie. Christian, let's start with you. What is your sweaty wig for the movie Corsage?
I was fearing this question. I find it very difficult to answer, because I guess I can reveal that I like the movie quite a lot, and I think she did it cleverly. There is probably the one sweaty wig for me is that I think that the relationship between her and Franz Josef sometimes, as I said earlier on, he was very affectionate towards her in real life. And I think she could have made more use of that in fact, there was a deep underlying love And as some historians suggest, she also loved him, but she just couldn't live the life he was leading, and she couldn't just live the life that as he was living his life, like with all the duties and the strict ceremony and so on. And I think she could have made a little bit more of that. You see an estranged couple in this film, which is certainly partly true, but which isn't the entire story. And I guess it would have been interesting to see a bit more of the love and affection that they apparently both still had for each other. So that's the only thing I would say that I think is the weak spot for me.
Okay. Very good. I like that sweaty week a lot. Yeah, it's very valid. Okay.
It's very deep.
It's very deep. No, it's an important one. Okay, Gabby. So what is your sweaty week this time?
Can I mention
Oh, we got two sweaty weeks.
Or only one.
There was a lot of hair in this movie. Enough to make two sweaty weeks. Come on.
Two small ones. I think I have already revealed myself with the previous discussion topic. My main sweaty week was the ship in the final scene. Because all the other elements I understood the wink, the twink in the eye, I could understand. But the final scene of her on this super modern ship, that was taking me too much. Then it took me, that it was not just a twink. It was like, I don't know, a too open strike. So that would be my main sweaty wick. And maybe along with that, it's also concerning the modern elements, let's say the modern elements on the film. And we have talked about this in other episodes on Wicks and Candles, Nanny, because I love these modern elements on period films. But I think in this film, with some things, they went a little bit too far with including modern elements. Like, as I said, my main sweaty week is this modern ship. And the other sweaty week, also regarding modern elements, is the hair of her daughter. We see Valerie a lot in this film. The 10-year-old Valerie, we see in many scenes. She's always wearing the same dress, which is okay. I found it kind of interesting, funny. But her hair is always open, completely open and not done. And that also was like, this wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
This wouldn't have happened. This is maybe also too much of the modern touch that the kid would have the hair open.
So those are very two interesting sweaty weeks. But the ship, we have agreed that is quite. But the hair, I didn't notice that. I don't know why. Maybe I was taking too many notes. But it's true. But it's true that yes, usually children, young girls, could wear their hair down. And you know, up to a certain, you know, once you reach like 14, 15, I don't know, you start to put your hair up pretty much for the rest of your life in public.
Well, but they would, they would maybe wear it open. But
they will know she was Valerie's just
hair was just
unkempt, undone, and she's a child at court. She would have had her hair done, like for sure.
So how about your sweaty weeks, Nanny?
My sweaty week, I had to look really deep because, like Christian, I really love this movie and I found nearly no faults with it. I really enjoyed it. So my sweaty weeks is very close to you, Gabby. It has to do with one of these modern anachronistic elements, and it's one scene that happens in Ludwig's castle. There's a scene where a beautiful scene where Ludwig and Sissi go swimming in a lake at night, and it's really a beautiful scene under the moonlight. A wonderful scene. But then they have a scene inside his living room where they're dancing. And there's this musician, this young boy, playing a song on a little mandolin, I think. And I think it's a modern song. I think pretty much all the songs that she used are modern songs. And this did not work for me. It just aesthetically and in the narrative, it just, I had to dig very, very deep. And I had to, okay, let's choose a scene that didn't work. But it's just a brief moment in the whole movie. So it's a very tiny, sweaty week, but that scene didn't quite work. But I think it has to do with the music and the, you know, some things, some anachronisms worked better than others. She was more successful better in some of them
totally.
Than others. So that was my story. Okay, so let's move on to the second question, which is, what is your shining candle? One thing you love? Okay, we should start with Christian again.
Well, what I loved, and it's not one issue or one thing, but it's in general the thing, how she managed to incorporate historical incidents, things that really happened that we know from her life, and combined it with this modern version or modern story about Sissi, so that you can say, even though she said, Marie Kreutzer said, that it's like her vision of Sissi, she was using a lot of historical facts and making sure that you cannot just say, well, this is just a fantasy version of Sissi and it has nothing to do with a real woman. I think it probably has more to do with a real woman than a lot of other Sissi movies, in particular the one from the German one from the 1950s, which had nothing to do with a real woman. So I think she does it very cleverly, kind of to take a freedom as a director on the one hand to get her message across, but still fact-based enough so that you think it relates to the real Empress. And I think that's something that she did very cleverly, and that by the end of the film I thought, this is very well done.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's my shining candle.
Oh, that's a fantastic shining candle, Christian. Thank you so much, because that goes to show, and it's not the case for me, that when you do know the history, I mean, you can enjoy this movie without knowing anything about Sissi, but how the enjoyment really increases the more you know about the period. I mean, if it's a bad movie, it will decrease. But in this case, the pleasure really goes up. When you have some historical background, like when you know a little bit more about the history. So that's a great point. And I think
maybe just to answer that very briefly, to add one thing there, because I think my initial thought was, yeah, what are you missing out on this film if you don't know the historic facts? But the more I thought about it is, I think she motivates you to read more about the historic facts and get more knowledge about the real life of Sissi. And I think that is probably also what it leads to and what I like about it. Yeah,
100%, because that's exactly what I did. So I agree with you with that. Okay, so thank you for that, Chris. So Gabby, what about you? What is your shining candle? One thing you loved?
I also have many things, but I'm going to go for one. Not to break all the rules. You mentioned the dancing scene at Ludwig's castle where the music was too modern for you, Nene, and it didn't quite work for you. And in my case, that was some of the anachronisms that she used that really worked well for me. I loved it. I loved the soundtrack. And we have to say that the main theme song, which is sung by an artist called Camille, the main song of the film, which is also a modern song. If I'm not mistaken, I don't know. Maybe the song is maybe, I don't know, 20 years ago or something. I don't know, 20 years old or something. It's a beautiful song. I love that. I love that element to use modern music in this context. And maybe it worked because she chose well, because she's, especially this main song, I think it's maybe just called Go, I don't know. She built it in so perfectly along the film. For me, it felt like the song was accompanying the story. Because it didn't repeat the parts of the song that they play along the film. It's not always the same part of the song. It's not always the same verse of the song. Whenever they play the song, they play another verse. So for me, it was like the song is also telling you part of the story. So I think that they did marvelously, this song accompanying the entire story and telling you this is how it would, this every verse of the song fitted so well to each scene and to each part of the song. They did marvelous. And of course, it's a great song. So of course, they didn't have to, it sounds like out of any time. You cannot really say this is a very 90s song or this is a very 2020 song, you know. It's a timeless song. So I think that they did very well. And the song you mentioned while doing my research, and I think maybe we watched the film at home and we had captions, even though we of course saw it in German. But we also had captions. So they showed you which songs they were playing. So that song that you meant is by Chris Christopherson. So it's a modern song and they adapted it to be played on this antique instrument. And I think that worked also very well because they took the core of the song and they put it exactly for me perfectly well in the time. So for me, the soundtrack, the modern soundtrack, all the songs are modern. There's also another song played later on that is also a modern song and it's also played in old instruments. I think that anachronism worked very well. So for me, The Shining Candle was the modern soundtrack. Of course, I would love to add the performance of Vicky Krieps, but we have talked about that before. Maybe we all agreed that this is maybe the main shining candle. But yeah, well, for me, the soundtrack.
Gabby, that is amazing. I keep screaming silently because it's not that I didn't like. First, I'm going to defend myself. It's not that I didn't like the version of the song. I think the scene didn't quite work. I think the boy just standing there awkwardly playing the song. It's just, and I say I had to dig very deep. But I do think that the soundtrack really worked, and especially that main song. And as we learn looking at her interviews, she got this question at every stop during the press tour, and she said, the music, it was not that I intended to make it modern, it's just that when I write, I use music. And the music was built into the script. So what you said is an amazing observation, because that's exactly what happened. As she was writing, she was incorporating the music that she was listening to, that was kind of informing emotionally and sonically and aesthetically the writing, the story. So that's, I think we can say that shining candle, she worked well. She really intended it. Okay, because we're taking too long, I'm going to say,
My shining
candle, I have mentioned it many times, is the cinematography of this movie. And I guess maybe it's because I had the luck to see it on the movie theater twice. And I'm going to mention the name. It's a woman, Judith Kaufman. And she shot this movie on film. You can really see it. For me, the light, all the light, whether it's indoor, outdoor, at night, really, really gives me a sense of time and place. And this is so important. Like, I could really feel those mountains. I could really feel those summer gardens. I mentioned briefly that scene that Cici has with her cousin Ludwig, where they swim naked in a lake under the moonlight. And this is shot so beautifully. There's also, you know, you can almost feel the wet grass, the you know, the dew of the morning. There's all kinds of things, you know, the dampness of the walls of these castles, the warmth of the tables. There's something very real about the world, which is, I think, achieved through the cinematography, the lighting of the movie, and how it looks. So that's my shining candle. Even though there were no candles.
Perfect.
Allowed in the set. Even though the director banned all candles, the light won. Okay, we have to keep going on this questionnaire. So our third question, and I think let's try to do it more briefly because we're going a bit long. The third question is, stolen costume. What piece of clothing would you like to keep? We also add like prop. Stolen costume or prop? So let's start with Chris quickly. What would you take from the set?
Yeah, I was thinking about that a lot. And I don't know, but I think I would take probably Franz Josef's uniform just to get a glimpse of how it feels or how he felt wearing that. So, yeah, while I was watching the film, I thought, how does it feel to be like kind of wearing this all day as a man? Just probably as you would wonder, how does it feel to wear a corsage all day? So yeah, I think I would get the uniform, not to wear it every day, but I think it would be interested how it feels to walk around in that. Yeah,
such a great answer.
It's a very iconic. It's a very
iconic.
Yeah. His uniform. Yeah, I will love to wear that too. Thank you, Christian. Now, Gabi, what is your stolen costume or prop that you would like to keep?
I'm suffering. My indecision. Okay, I'm going to go for something easy. At the very, 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 very last part of the film where the credits are rolling, the actress Vicky Krieps is dancing as Sissi with her long hair in an empty room, and she's wearing a robe, a very beautiful robe with a lot of, it looks like it has like a lot of golden, like a golden pattern, and it looks so lofty and just beautiful. So I guess I would take that robe. It's a gown. It's like an open gown. It's like a morning gown. It looks beautiful.
Well, you're going to have to fight me for that robe.
Oh my gosh.
That was also the piece of clothing that I want to keep from that set. I mean, okay. It's gorgeous.
Okay. We take turns.
We can take turns. I mean, it's just a very memorable closing scene. We're not going to spoil the movie. The movie ends, and then we have the credits, which are not fade to black. Is a scene of her dancing, like twirling around in this wonderful room, like when she was doing fencing, I think, and she's just dancing around. There's no sound but the music, and the reddits are scrolling like on the side. It's gorgeous. And, you know, her hair is flowing, and she's wearing...
And the hair is open.
Yeah, and she's wearing kind of like this mourning robe that looks like very cushiony silk. I don't know, it's just... Make two copies for, please.
But you know, I was torn. Well, I am always torn with every question. I always want to answer two things.
Okay, what was your second
as
stolen?
Usual, because I'm very
interested. You can take that.
Because the other stolen piece of costume would be all these veils that they use. Because this is unusual. I hadn't seen those face veils in other films, and they made it so beautiful, and they also did a lot of close-ups on these headpieces with the veil in front of the face. I thought they were also very cute.
Oh, they were amazing. Well, if we are going to fight about the robe, I can also take another piece. She wore throughout history people wore chemise underneath the clothing to keep the very expensive clothing clean. Right, so you wear a chemise and you will put everything on top of that, the corset, the dress, all the pieces. Da, 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 da. She wears a sleeveless chemise where you can see her toned arms. It looks so amazing. What a striking piece of, like, so memorable, right? So unusual. And it becomes part of her look very much when she's sitting and she, there's so many things that happen. And this is a very important piece of costume.
When she's like, yeah, when she's on her own, just like relax and she's not.
Exactly. When she's in her.
Exactly. And she's,
bedroom.
She's in her room and she wears that a lot.
It's an iconic piece.
It was okay. Remarkable. It's
so beautiful. We can take turns.
Yeah, we share everything.
We share everything so we anyway. Share. Okay, last question in the Wicks and Candles quiz. Let's start with Christian. If given the chance, would you time travel to the period? Yes, no, why?
I can return, right? I don't have to stay there, right? It's just to
time travel,
there,
yeah. Time travel, yeah.
Yes, if I have a chance to return afterwards, yes, I would most definitely want to go to that period. I think to me it's one of the most interesting because as she is always portrayed, you see you're on the brink of a massive change that then a few years later or 20, 25 years later happens with the beginning of the First World War. And that kind of brings the end to this form of monarchy nearly all over Europe and really changes Europe tremendously. Yeah? New empires fall to pieces and new countries, new nations emerge. And so, yes, I would most definitely want to be there to see how foreseeable or this development probably was at the time already. Like, would you experience that people realized that they were like experiencing to be at the dawn of a new age that was coming, or were they kind of really taken by being completely puzzled and by these incidents happening, and to kind of find out how foreseeable it probably was or not. I would be very interested. So, yes, I would definitely travel there.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Christian. Oh, amazing. What about you, Gabby?
I would say yes, but I am a little bit biased. I would say yes because I love Austria and I've been to... Well, we were living in Germany. We went to Austria many times, and now we even moved to Austria. And there is one town where we spent a little holiday, where Sisi used to spend some of her summer holidays as well, but Ischl. And this place is magical. And it's all full of all these houses and buildings of that period. And it looks all so amazing. And I guess I would love to take a stroll down there's a promenade along the river, and it's all made of this, in all this style of the period. I would love to take a stroll in a dress down that promenade with my husband in arm, looking like Franz Josef.
He can wear the uniform.
I would love to take a stroll looking like that and during that time and going to a cafe, an Austrian cafe, and eat pastries, all these traditional things. Because, I don't know, maybe we are living we just dwell in this myth of that time because people tend to romanticize this period in Austrian history a lot, which is certainly not as glamorous, nothing as glamorous as we think it was. But I love this picture. I love this picture of Austrian in the end of the 19th century. And I would like to take one week in 1870-something in Bad Ischl. I would book it right away.
Yeah, I would go along with that.
Yes.
I would join you there.
Let's book it.
How about you?
Yes, but with a lot of conditions. I said yes if it's the exact same place where she was, because I was just mesmerized by the beauty of the Alps, you know, this area, Bavaria, which you know well because you live there and I've been lucky to visit. So I know how it feels. I know how it smells. There's a kind of magical feeling to that place, which is its connection to nature, which is portrayed very well in the movie. So yes, if I get to go to the summer castles and swim in the lake under the moonlight and ride the horses in the morning dew, but if I have to go to the mental hospital that she visit, unfortunately not, because there's some sad parts of the period that we see as well. And obviously all the repression that she suffered as well. I would not like to experience it. Yeah, as well. We'll time travel, but just spend a week on the summer castle, eating some cream cakes, hot chocolate. What else?
Apple strudel
every day. Yeah, that I will do. And then come back. Because I'm probably buying into the... Definitely buying into the world that the director created, which was a very stripped down 19th century.
It was very minimalist.
Very minimalist. So I am buying into that, and it's very appealing to me. Like, return to a simpler time, which is a fantasy in the end, of course. All right. Okay, perfect. So to wrap our discussion, we are going to rate the movie, and let's just do it as fast as we can, because we have definitely taken a long time, and it's mostly my fault. All right. So our rating is from 1 to 10. So one candle is, one means a very sweaty week. 10 is all the weeks and candles. Very shining candles. So the rate is from 1 to 10. So let's start with Christian. How many wicks and candles do you give Corsage?
I make it very quick. I think I give it 8. I give it 8 candles.
Excellent. What about you, Gabby?
Okay, I thought he wanted to add something to that. I'm going to go for a 9 because I loved it. I think it is a unique film of this time. This unusual style for a period film worked out very well. I loved so many things. Like, what we love about this Nene, and it's part of the core of our podcast series, it's directed, written, performed by women. Oof. It's amazing. And you get this touch. You get this touch of what they wanted to tell us. And that was beautiful. So I'm going to go for a 9. The candle that I'm removing from the top score is because some anachronisms didn't quite work for me. But all in general, 9 wicks and candles because it is an extraordinary film.
Excellent. I'm going to give it 8. All the candles that he gets is because, yes, it's written, directed, performed. The vision is all by women, which is very important. And I think it definitely adds to the perspective that we get. It's a very intimate perspective. It's an extraordinary portrayal of a very human person. Like, you can feel a three-dimensional human being presented there. It's a truly amazing performance, unforgettable, by this actress Vicky Krieps. The wicks and candles I'm taking, perhaps the relationship, like Christian mentioned, the relationship with the emperor. Those scenes didn't quite work for me. They were a bit disappointed. I felt quite sad for her. You know, like, I didn't quite understand what her need was, and I think we explore that as well. And I think the anachronism as well, like those little touches there, like the music, that didn't quite work. But overall, an unforgettable movie. So I think the movie gets 25 candles out of 30, potential 30. That's amazing.
That's quite good.
All right. Well, we have reached the end of our discussion of Corsage. Thank you so much, Christian, for being here. This was actually our dream.
Thank you so much for having me.
We wrote it down on the script, and we force you to read and not change any words But the truth is that we are so happy to have you. We've been talking about having you for a long time, and this was the perfect movie, and we've been dreaming about it for months. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And
yeah, thank you also from my side, because I am more than happy and convinced that all your insights were extremely valuable to our discussion and to our conversation. This has been a very, very special episode.
Yeah.
Thank you for playing along.
Thank you. And I have to thank you, Gabby, as well, because, you know, you always have such amazing insights, and, you know, we always have different ideas. But in the end, what we agree in is that we love period films, especially period films about women, because we just love to learn about their lives and, you know, how history has either forgotten them, portrayed them, honored them. This is the pleasure that we get. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for being here. Go watch Corsage. It's available for streaming in Europe and in movie theaters in North America. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Stay tuned.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wicks and Candles is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
So go ahead and subscribe and follow us on Instagram at Wicks and Candles. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.
Wicks and Candles is written, hosted, and produced by Andreina Romero and Gabriela Morken Romero. The image design is by Pamela Rollin. The podcast theme music is the Concerto for Two Violins in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach.